Today's episode is brought to you by Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast. When you think about the future, what kind of technology do you envision? Whatever the future holds, artificial intelligence will undoubtedly be at the heart of it all. Join Graham Klass as he hosts Season 2 of Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast, and hear from the minds transforming healthcare, retail, entertainment, personal computing, and more with the help of AI. Tune in every other Tuesday and explore the latest technology that's changing our world today and creating a more accessible tomorrow. Listen to Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
What's up, this your boy Lil Duval, and check out my podcast, Conversations with Unc, on the Black Effect Podcast Network. Each and every Tuesday, Conversations with Unc podcast feature casuals and in-depth talk about ebbs and flows of life and the pursuit of happiness. Unlike my work on stage, I tap into a more serious and sensitive side to give life advice and simply offer words of encouragement, yet remind folks to never forget to laugh. Every Tuesday, listen to Conversations with Unc, hosted by Lil Duval on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Presented by AT&T. Connecting changes everything.
We are the voice of NASCAR.
The green flag is in the air, and we are underway the great American race.
The Motor Racing Network. NASCAR Cup, Xfinity, and Craftsman Truck Series Racing. Live on your hometown radio station and MRN or NASCAR.com. Martinsville, Talladega, the Chicago Street Course. We have the side-by-side action and last lap passes for the win.
Photo finishes. Ryan Blaney will win.
The voice of NASCAR, the Motor Racing Network.
Hey guys, back at the playground again, huh?
Yep. You know what this playground could use? A wine country.
Heck yeah! And some waves so we could go surfing.
Oh, yeah. Ah, love that!
A redwood forest would be cool.
I'm in!
Ah, ski slopes.
Let's do it!
Can a girl go shopping?
Yeah, baby!
Wait! Did we just invent California?
Discover why California is the ultimate playground at visitcalifornia.com.
Welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind, a production of iHeartRadio.
Hey, welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind. My name is Robert Lamb.
And I'm Joe McCormick, and we're back with part two of our discussion of sinkholes. Now, in the last episode, we talked about some fabulous examples of sinkholes that suddenly open up and reveal interesting things below. We talked about how sinkholes form, how the geology and hydrology of sinkholes, and we talked about some interesting specific examples in the world. But today we wanted to get into some things about like the religious significance of sinkholes and sinkholes as a scientific tool that can help show us things about the past, and also maybe some sinkholes in space. But I thought sinkholes in religion would be a good place to start, because one of the interesting ways of conceptualizing deities is that deities are often manifestations of natural forces and natural resources. And of course, one of the most important natural resources is water. So there are all kinds of water deities around the world. Coastal civilizations and cultures will have deities associated with the ocean that are very important in their culture. But if you're more inland, there will often be deities associated with where you get your fresh water, either a very important river, or there are lots of holy wells that are found throughout the history of Europe. Both pagan and Christian, there are a lot of like holy wells and water sources. And the same is true of many sinkholes in ancient Mesoamerica.
That's right. In particular, the sacred cenotes of the Maya, which is what we'd like to talk about here. I was reading a piece, a really nice piece on mexicolore.co.uk by Maya archaeologist Andrew Kinkela. Just titled Sacred Sinkholes, and he discusses some of what we've already mentioned in regard to, you know, the large number of these sinkholes or cenotes in Mesoamerica. The entire area is situated on a limestone bedrock, and we end up with these hollows, and then they collapse, and then, of course, then they often fill with water. We're left with something that's not just a deep pit, which alone can be pretty interesting, but pits with water, often from deep underground. So you're often talking clean water, clear water, an ideal resource. Some of these contain as much as like 50 meters of water, he points out.
Yeah, there are a lot of fascinating things about these sinkholes, one of which, just before I forget, I wanted to call attention to. They explore some of these cenotes in the Yucatan Peninsula in the documentary that we recently interviewed Werner Herzog and Clive Oppenheimer about. There's a segment where they – so that documentary is called Fireball, and it's about impacts from space and the scars they leave on Earth and what we can learn from them. And one of the things they explore is if you look at a map of the cenotes of the Yucatan Peninsula, there's one part of the Yucatan where there is this almost perfect partial ring of cenotes. And it's like, what's going on there? And that apparently corresponds to the outer rim of the crater that was left by the impact from the KPG extinction, the large space impact that probably contributed significantly to the extinction of the non-avian dinosaurs. And so in Fireball, there's a segment where Clive Oppenheimer goes down into one of these beautiful ancient cenotes with a local researcher, and they talk about not just what it can tell us geologically, we might get a little bit more into that later, but also what it means religiously.
Yeah. So especially for areas far from rivers, these cenotes became very important for just purely practical reasons. Like, this is where you could get water. This enabled you to live and have communities that existed further away from those rivers. But then they ended up taking on religious power as well. And Kinkela writes that the ancient Maya regarded cenotes as one of the three symbolic entryways to Xibalba, the Mayan underworld. So eventually this kind of, he describes it as a cenote cult emerges, devoted to venturing out, like taking these pilgrimages to different cenotes, collecting water from them, from the different ones, and making offerings up to the watery depths. And their role, these priests, these pilgrims, their role would have been seen as vitally important, especially during times of drought, you know, when the resources of the cenotes becomes, in doubt or seems threatened, like they seem to have a role in trying to maintain the balance, to try and maintain the bountiful gifts of these places. I was also looking at an article on National Geographic titled Secrets of the Maya and Otherworld, and this was by Alma Guillermo Prieto. And this is about the sinkholes that we've been discussing here and about how they were also associated with a key deity, which was Chak, I believe, it's spelled in this article as C-H-A-A-K.
I've also seen it with a C-H-A-A-C, I think.
Yeah. So here's what they wrote in this article, quote, or this is just a really, I think, telling passage from it. Quote, for men like Unkin, the old gods are still very much alive, and Chak, ruler of cenotes and caves, is among the most important gods of all. For the benefit of living things, he pours from the skies the water he keeps in earthenware jars and caves. Chak is one in many. Each thunderclap is a separate Chak in action, breaking a jar open and letting the rain fall. Each god inhabits a separate layer of reality, along with dozens of alternately complacent and ferocious gods that live in the 13 other worlds above and the 9 other worlds below. Together, they filled the Maya people's lives with dreams, visions, and nightmares, a complicated calendar of agricultural times and fertility rituals, and a firm sense of the way things must be done. Chak had moved, Unkin said, and that meant the planting season would soon arrive.
That's beautiful.
Yeah, yeah. So in this, we see that a cave or cenote could be seen as a dwelling place of Chak, but it could also be seen as this yawning maw of the earth, or even this gateway to deeper realms of reality.
Yeah, and this combines the multiple versions. So you can, of course, see these cenotes as a gateway to the underworld and a source of water. But I was also reading in a different National Geographic article about like the specifics of certain cenotes. Like, it's not just all cenotes are religiously equivalent. There would be, for example, some cenotes in specific locations that have different religious significance for the people who live nearby. The one I was thinking of was a cenote that, as the ancient Mayan city had a wall, there was many cenotes within the wall that could be used as a water source. But there's one cenote outside the city wall that it seems was regarded primarily as a place for the burial of the dead. And there have been many human remains found down inside that one.
There are a whole slew of them with different significances. The most famous of the cenotes is probably the sacred cenote at the Maya site of Chichen Itza, where there was it's been a place of a fair amount of study. There was a small building by it that was apparently used for blood sacrifices, again, tying into traditions related to the sacredness of the spot and the continuation of water. A variety of sacred objects were also apparently cast into the cenote, including precious jade artifacts, gold and copper discs, foods, and other organic items that we actually can find, evidence of. But so you think of this as like an opening up into the world below, where you might throw offerings, where you might make sacrifices of material or sacrifices of blood.
It's hard for me not to sort of connect this to some of the stuff we were talking about in the previous episode, where there is a pretty clear link between pumping too much groundwater up. There are certain places where there's a need for massive irrigation of fields, maybe sometime to like protect a certain crop from frost or something. So you will pump just tons and tons of water to put over the fields. So much that you really lower the level of the groundwater and suddenly cause lots of sinkholes to open up, where the water pressure is not what it was below. The overburden can't hold up its own weight and then collapses. And this has happened in the U.S. in places like Florida. I mean, it's very easy to see how something like that could be interpreted as the wrath of the gods, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. You're messing with the domain of the earth gods. Now, one of the interesting things about these Mesoamerican traditions concerning cenotes is that it's also thought that that native peoples elsewhere in the Americas probably carried some of these ideas with them. And so when you encounter some North American cenotes, there's evidence that native peoples may have used them as burial places as well, given them places of importance in their worldviews. And one such place is Devil's Sinkhole, northwest of San Antonio. It's now a state park, but it's 140 feet deep or 43 meters deep. And apparently there's evidence that ancient peoples came here and probably held it in some esteem. But one of the really crazy natural world things about Devil's Sinkhole is that it is home to, or at least part of the year, it is home to 3 million Mexican free-tailed bats.
Wow, that's a lot of bats.
Yeah, so they migrate to Mexico for the cooler months, but they roost up in the sinkhole other parts of the year. And We've talked about how amazing bats are in the show before, and especially insectivore bats, that eat insects. Well, it's been estimated that the bats that live in Devil's Sinkhole, again, something like 3 million Mexican free-tailed bats, that they consume an estimated 30 tons of beetles and moths each night. Each night, 30 tons, 30 tons of beetles and moths. That's crazy.
That's one of those facts that makes you wonder how many tons of beetles there just are already. Like, half the beetles in the area? Is that 1% of the beetles in the area?
Yeah. I mean, it's just a tremendous biomass out there, and these bats are here for it.
And most of it is insect or arthropod in some way, or, most of the animal is arthropod in some way. And wow, that's just amazing. You can measuring insects or beetles in units of like garbage truck fulls.
Yeah. So I love this because, this is a great example of just sort of how, like we said in the last episode, when a sinkhole occurs, it does not, create this natural void. Like, things will move into the sinkhole. Things will take advantage of this new aspect of the geography. And in this case, the bats make it their home. So if you live in the San Antonio area, you've visited there and you've been to Devil's Sinkhole, I'd love to hear about your experience checking it out. I know if you go during the right time of the year, you can actually observe the bats moving in and out of the cavern area. So it sounds beautiful.
I've read that there are also, one of the things is that belief in the sacredness of sinkholes and their association with the world of the gods is not just an ancient belief. It's not necessarily extinct. I mean, there are people today for whom sinkholes hold sacred importance. And if you are one of those people or know some, I'd like to hear about that too.
Yeah. I'd love to hear, especially the details about any modern rites associated with it and, mm-hmm. And just sort of the belief system built up around it, the stories. Shout out to Astapro for sponsoring this episode and providing us with free samples.
Rob, as the local host with allergies here, they sent you some of their nasal spray to treat your allergies. What was your experience like?
Yeah, that's right. I always wrestle with the pollen a bit when it rolls in during the spring. So they sent me the little nasal spray. I tried out the product and it sure did help me get on top of my symptoms for the day. And it's so fast acting, it was already kicking in before I left the house.
Astapro is a first-of-its-kind nasal allergy spray. It's the fastest 24-hour over-the-counter allergy spray. It starts working in 30 minutes, while other allergy sprays take hours. Astapro is the first and only 24-hour steroid-free allergy spray. Astapro delivers full prescription-strength indoor and outdoor allergy relief from nasal congestion, runny and itchy nose, and sneezing.
Get fast-acting nasal allergy symptom relief with Astapro. Go to astaproallergy.com for a discount so you can get Astapro and go today. Astepro allergy.com. Astapro and go. Use as directed for relief of nasal congestion, runny nose, sneezing, and itchy nose due to allergies.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can waste another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can conquer it. I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. Any road. The steeper, the better. Because my all-new Santa Fe is available with H-Track all-wheel drive, so I can hit the trail without a worry in the world. Heck, with three rows and best-in-class rear cargo space, I can pack the whole family in with all our gear. We've got available dual wireless charging for our phones, so we'll never lose touch with civilization, and we won't lose touch with the primordial power of Mother Earth. So which is it? Waste the weekend or do something a little more epic? And conquer it in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
Today's episode is brought to you by eBay. eBay Motors is here for the ride. Remember when you first saw the potential? And then, through some elbow grease, fresh installs, and a whole lot of love, you transformed 100,000 miles in a body full of rust into a drive that's all your own. Look to your left. Look to your right. It's official. No one's got a ride like this. There's nothing else that sounds like, feels like, or looks like the set of wheels in your garage. With over 122 million parts, you can make sure your number one ride or die stays running smoothly, so there's no limit to how far you can take it. Brake kits, turbochargers, engines, exhaust kits, roof racks, LED headlights, bumpers, whatever your baby needs, eBay Motors has it. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time, or your money back. Plus, at these prices, well, you're burning rubber, not cash. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply.
Snag a Job is where America goes to hire, with the deepest talent pool in hourly hiring. With access to over 6 million active hourly workers, Snag a Job is the all-in-one solution for hiring high-quality employees who can cover all your needs. On demand, temp to hire, part-time or full-time. You name the position. Warehouse worker, retail associate, grocery store clerk, fitness trainer, baker, stylist, bellhop, podcast producer? Yeah, Snagajob's got a worker for that. With our easy-to-use platform, you're able to seamlessly post and fill available positions quickly, with a dedicated customer support team to provide all the help you need along the way. Kind of nice knowing you have a talent pool like that in your own backyard, right? Snagajob is the partner you need to keep your business running smoothly. So visit snagajob.com or text snag to 242424 to talk to an expert. Snagajob.com, where America goes to hire.
Now, one of the things we mentioned in the previous episode is that the sinkhole is a natural feature that can inadvertently serve as a type of scientific instrument, much in the same way that like ancient ice, you know, it's like nobody intended it to be this way, but we can learn things about the ancient climate from taking ice cores. So that, you know, those layers of ice really give us a lot to read into the history of the Earth. And apparently sinkholes can do the same thing, right?
That's right. I mean, you know, we think about how they gobble up parts of the surface world. And yeah, they do sometimes do scientists a huge favor by collecting and to some degree preserving evidence of past life forms, even past like storm activity and climates of ancient times. Mm-hmm. And so when we venture into the sinkhole with the right tools or with the right methods, we're able to uncover those secrets that have been preserved there. And there have been numerous studies that have looked at sinkholes and gathered specific information from these sinkholes. And we're not going to be able to give a full overview of them here in this episode, but I wanted to touch on some that I thought provided a reasonable overview and an idea of what sort of stuff we can learn from sinkholes. So for instance, in 2014, a team from the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign studied genetic information extracted from the tooth of an adolescent girl who fell into a sinkhole in the Yucatan some 12,000 to 13,000 years ago. And her remains were found alongside the remains of ancient beasts. Because, you know, what occurs is some of these really treacherous sinkholes is like things will fall in. Mm-hmm. And then they cannot get out. And, of course, they die down there. They decay down there. And the remains are down there for us to later discover and study.
Oh, I hadn't thought about this, but I wonder if sinkholes are one of these things, one of these terrain features that can serve as a natural predator trap. A predator mm-hmm. trap is, I guess, a concept in the interaction between the landscape and the animals that live nearby. But, you know, a classic example is like the La Brea tar pits, you know, so an animal becomes stranded and dies in it. And then the smell attracts predators or scavengers who then themselves become trapped. Another example I was reading about not too long ago was there is a geologically active valley in the Kamchatka Peninsula where often like birds are killed by volcanic fumes and then their decaying bodies attract predators into the area who then also are killed by the fumes and it leads to this feedback cycle.
Yeah, yeah. It's I think in some cases they definitely are serving as predator traps. So in this particular study, one of the reasons this tooth was so important is that the researchers were studying the influx of humans into the Americas and wanted to see if a specimen such as this, with a skull shape that is unusual among other Native American lineages, they wanted to see if it fell in line genetically with those lineages or represented something else, perhaps lining up with theories about migration from Southeast Asia or even Australia that didn't come in through the Bering Strait. Mm-hmm. And they found that their remains did line up with Bering Strait or Beringian migration.
Okay.
So that's just one cool example.
Okay, let's hear another.
All right, yeah. Here's one from 2019. Researchers from the Florida Museum of Natural History looked at the preserved bones of a Crichton's carcara, an extinct carrion-eating falcon from the Caribbean that was killed off roughly 1,000 years ago when humans first entered the region, and they were looking at these remains in a flooded sinkhole on Great Abaco Island in the Bahamas. And the hole is a sawmill sink, a 100-foot-deep, dark, oxygen-free environment that preserved the 2,500-year-old bones of this creature enough that they could conduct genetic studies of it. In fact, the bone yielded 98.7% of the bird's mitochondrial genome, which is pretty impressive. Again, it's like a deep cooler, you know. It preserves these remains that if they were dropped, you know, in other places on the world would have just been long lost.
No ice required.
Here's another one of note. In 2018, another study from the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign studied the remains of a giant sloth that fell into a sinkhole in what is now Carablanca in central Belize 27,000 years ago. And in this, the tooth, humerus, and femur were partially fossilized, but there was still enough unaltered tissue for stable carbon and oxygen isotope analysis to study what the sloth ate. And this in turn revealed details about local climate and local environment there in that region at that time, which is pretty astounding.
Did it say exactly what the sloth did eat?
I didn't get into the nuts and berries of that, but basically, suffice to say, I'd love to come back and discuss giant ground sloths more in the future, though. But but basically, it provided them the information they needed to actually gaze back in the past and consider what it was consuming, and that means what was around it, what was how it was able to make its home in the world at that time. So it's pretty amazing.
We could probably do a whole episode or series of episodes just on really interesting studies, finding out what ancient peoples and creatures ate using analyses, chemical analyses of these kinds.
Yeah. I mean, it reveals so much. It reveals so much.
Absolutely. One I was just reading not too long ago that was kind of funny to me was a chemical analysis of a gigantic coprolite found, or I think it was around the city of York in England, that revealed it was left by a human, I think like 1,000 years ago or so, roughly, and revealed a diet heavy in meat and bread, but also just riddled with intestinal worms.
So then you get the double. You have the fossilized poop, but then also the fossilized creatures that were writhing inside it. Awesome, yeah. Awesome.
Or I guess if it's about 1,000 years ago, I'm not sure if that counts as fossilized. I don't know. That's a good question. I don't know. So it was, poop from hundreds of years ago. So, roughly around 1,000 years ago. But is that technically a fossil, or is that just very well preserved poop?
We'll have to come back and discuss in the future.
Okay.
Here's a 2020 study from Goethe University in Frankfurt. They dove into one of the most impressive sinkholes in the world, the Blue Hole. I believe we mentioned this in the last episode, at least in passing. This is a flooded karst sinkhole on Lighthouse Reef in Belize. And they were able to drill up and analyze a sedimentary, quote, storm archive covering 2,000 years of history built layer by layer by layer in the dark depths of this hole. And it revealed a lot about the frequency of tropical storms in that area over time. They found, quote, hurricanes in the Caribbean became more frequent and their force varied noticeably around the same time that classical Mayan culture in Central America suffered its final demise. So again, just a chance to gaze back in time and see what was going on, with the climate and with weather patterns by looking into the sinkhole.
So is the suggestion there, I assume it's not totally known, but the suggestion there may be that the organizational decline of the Mayan civilization was in some ways possibly related to changes in weather patterns?
That's my understanding, that it would have impacted that civilization and would have potentially contributed. Yeah. Mm. I also ran across a 2017 study from the University of Hawaii at Manoa that looked into Makawai Cave in Kauai, the largest limestone cave in Hawaii and only accessible via a sinkhole. So it's a rich fossil site, providing insight into Hawaiian life. The sinkhole, a paleo lake, contains 10,000 years of sedimentary information, revealing a rich diversity of natural information as well as Polynesian artifacts. So in this study, they were able to find supporting evidence in the coral fragments there to discover the source of the mega earthquake in the Aleutian Islands that spawned the devastating 1586 tsunami that hit Sanriku, Japan. So, again, it goes beyond merely being able to go in and find the remains of creatures, which is, I think, the first place your mind goes when you think about sinkholes. But able to be able to go in there and find some shattered bits of coral and then compare that to other bits of information and sort of piece together like seismic activities that occurred centuries ago.
Mm-hmm.
And I have one more here. This one's really fun too. Back in 1970, a 25,000-year-old sinkhole in Wyoming, a natural trap cave in Bighorn Canyon, was found. It measured 15 feet across, about 85 feet deep. And when they went into it, they discovered fossils of mammoths, short-faced bears, camels, and collared lemmings. But they ended up boarding it up after that for 30 years to prevent accidental falls, because the Natural Park Service, I was reading, describes that this particular sinkhole is, quote, virtually impossible to see until it is directly underfoot.
Ooh.
And if you look at pictures of it, yeah, it looks – because if you fell – like it widens out underneath, so you wouldn't like skid along the side of this, or even like you would just plummet down to the bottom.
Yeah, it's not a cone. It's not even a cylinder. It's like a jug with a you know, bottle opening.
Yeah, so it's very impressive. You should look it up. They have some wonderful pictures of it. The National Park Service does. But they ended up boarding it up for 30 years. But when scientists finally got a chance to dig in again, they discovered numerous large prehistoric mammal bones and even complete skeletons of smaller mammals. And they said that it ultimately functioned like a refrigerator, even preserving collagen in some of the bones. It wound up containing a whopping 30,000 specimens, they say. And on top of this, scientists are still studying what the cave can reveal about ancient human migration, ancient climate. So again, just another cache of information about the past that we find in one of these sinkholes.
Now, I'm sorry if I missed this. Do they know if this huge cache of different animal specimens, is that a result of some kind of natural deposition process, or is that the result of humans, like humans putting animal remains into the sinkhole?
My understanding is that this would have been animals accidentally falling in over the ages. But I could be wrong on that. I guess it's possible that some of these bodies would have been thrown in. But my impression was that we were dealing with things that had made the very mistake that the National Park Service was warning about. You know, mm-hmm. about it being virtually impossible to see it until it's directly underfoot. Like, you've got to do a real dexterity saving throw to avoid falling to the bottom of this baby.
Yeah. At disadvantage.
Yes.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can waste another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can conquer it. I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. Any road. The steeper, the better. Because my all-new Santa Fe is available with H-Track all-wheel drive, so I can hit the trail without a worry in the world. Heck, with three rows and best-in-class rear cargo space, I can pack the whole family in with all our gear. We've got available dual wireless charging for our phones, so we'll never lose touch with civilization, and we won't lose touch with the primordial power of Mother Earth. So which is it? Waste the weekend or do something a little more epic and conquer it in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
Today's episode is brought to you by eBay. eBay Motors is here for the ride. Remember when you first saw the potential? And then, through some elbow grease, fresh installs, and a whole lot of love, you transformed 100,000 miles and a body full of rust into a drive that's all your own. Look to your left. Look to your right. It's official. No one's got a ride like this. There's nothing else that sounds like, feels like, or looks like the set of wheels in your garage. With over 122 million parts, you can make sure your number one ride or die stays running smoothly, so there's no limit to how far you can take it. Brake kits, turbochargers, engines, exhaust kits, roof racks, LED headlights, bumpers, whatever your baby needs, eBay Motors has it. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time, or your money back. Plus, at these prices, well, you're burning rubber, not cash. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply.
Snag a Job is where America goes to hire, with the deepest talent pool in hourly hiring. With access to over 6 million active hourly workers, Snag a Job is the all-in-one solution for hiring high-quality employees who can cover all your needs. On demand, temp to hire, part-time or full-time. You name the position. Warehouse worker, retail associate, grocery store clerk, fitness trainer, baker, stylist, bellhop, podcast producer? Yeah, Snagajob's got a worker for that. With our easy-to-use platform, you're able to seamlessly post and fill available positions quickly, with a dedicated customer support team to provide all the help you need along the way. Kind of nice knowing you have a talent pool like that in your own backyard, right? Snagajob is the partner you need to keep your business running smoothly. So visit snagajob.com or text snag to 242424 to talk to an expert. Snagajob.com, where America goes to hire.
Today's episode is brought to you by Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast. When you think about the future, what kind of technology do you envision? Whatever the future holds, artificial intelligence will undoubtedly be at the heart of it all. Join Graham Klass as he hosts Season 2 of Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast from Ruby Studio in partnership with Intel. Explore the future of technology that's rapidly evolving our world today with the help of AI. There's still so much work and research needed to fully understand the power and potential of AI, and Intel is at the forefront of implementing AI in revolutionary technology that's changing the world we live in for the better. In each episode, Graham interviews the minds transforming medicine and healthcare, retail, entertainment, personal computing, and more while pioneering new uses for AI in these spaces. Tune in every other Tuesday and explore the latest technology that's changing our world today and creating a more accessible tomorrow. Listen to Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Okay, well, I've got another one for you. Obviously, it would be bad to suddenly plunge down into a sinkhole unwittingly on Earth, but what if you were to do it in space?
Oh, wow. Well, that would be even worse.
Well, actually, you might think so, but I just now thought of a condition that would make it maybe not nearly as bad. I don't know. We'll get into that.
I mean, I would hate to fall into a sinkhole like the one we just described in general, but what if then you, I mean, because you get to the bottom, what, you're injured, maybe you're going to starve to death or, you know, die of your wounds or die of exposure down there. Maybe there's a recently fallen animal down there you can eat. Or maybe there's something down there that is going to eat you. There's so many horrible ways it could go. But space is a lonely place to die, so I don't know.
How true that is. So I want to talk about a space object, an object called Comet 67P Churyumov-Gerasimenko. Now, this comet is called 67P because it is the 67th periodic comet discovered in our solar system. It was found in 1969 at an observatory in Russia by an astronomer named Klim Ivanovich Churyumov from a photographic plate that was taken by Svetlana Ivanova Gerasimenko. And 67P, like I said, is a periodic comet, meaning that it's a comet with a relatively short orbit that we've documented repeatedly returning to the inner solar system. Some comets, you know, they're just way, way out there and they're never going to get close to the sun, so we don't really have any chance to get a good look at them. This is one of the ones that comes in at one angle of its orbit pretty close to the sun. And astronomers have, of course, sighted it a bunch of times since it was first discovered, since it comes around every 6.5 years or so. If you've seen pictures of a comet up close, there's a good chance it was this one. It's kind of L-shaped or sort of like a bent barbell with a very short handle. It has these two lobes of crust or rocky, icy material in its nucleus. It also kind of looks like a bent double mushroom. It probably originally came from the Kuiper Belt, which is a large, loose collection of icy objects that extends far out past the orbit of Neptune. So if you go out past all of the planets, you know, you go past the gas giants, past Neptune, into the realm of Pluto, and then from there on out, there's just sort of this big shell around the solar system of space and these icy objects that if they're perturbed in just the right way, if they get flung off of their deep orbital path and thrown down into the inner solar system, they can become these familiar periodic comets. And that appears to be what happened to 67P. It was probably flung on this path that occasionally brings it close to the sun, when long ago it was subject to a collision or a gravitational disturbance by some other object. At its biggest dimensions, it's a little over 4 kilometers or about 2.5 miles long and wide, so it would be big enough to walk on, but not nearly as big as a planet or even a moon. Now, we know a lot about 67P and have great pictures of it because it was the target of the ESA, the European Space Agency, Rosetta mission, which actually landed a probe on the surface of this comet and took a bunch of amazing photos, among other things. And there's a lot that's really interesting about this comet. There's likely one amazing short video or GIF that you've seen from its surface. And this was made out of a series of still images taken by the lander that were sequenced together into an animation where it looks kind of like there's a snowstorm or a blizzard raining down onto the surface. Rob, have you seen this animation before?
Yes, I believe so.
It's really amazing. Now, it does need some qualification that this is not actually a snowstorm like we would experience here on Earth. And the animation that we see is a sped up animation. It takes something, I think, like 25 minutes of original, time lapse between the different photos and compresses it into a few seconds of a panning camera shot. So it's not actually a snowstorm, but probably more like the movements of dust particles and the star field as the comet travels. But it's still just one of the most strange and beautiful images I've seen made out of photos taken by a space probe.
Yeah, I mean, it's absolutely otherworldly.
Now, there are a lot of things that were interesting about the Rosetta mission, including the ways that the Rosetta mission kind of went wrong. Do you remember this, when it was trying to put the Philae lander down on the surface of the comet and how it kind of bounced in a way it wasn't supposed to?
I remember this being a point in the news around the time it happened, yeah.
Yeah, so the Rosetta mission had a lander that separated from the orbiter craft, and then the lander was supposed to touch down on the surface of the comet, and I believe it was supposed to fire these harpoons that would lock it into the surface so it didn't float away again, because, again, thinking about the gravity of a comet, its mass is so small compared to the kind of gravity we're used to on planets or moons that you can quite easily drift away from it if you've really got any momentum at all. I believe I read that the escape velocity from this comet was 1 meter per second. So if you're, moving away from its center of mass at 1 meter per second or more, you're not going to fall back down. You're just going to keep drifting away. But anyway, what I think happened with the lander was that it was supposed to fire these harpoons to lock it into the surface, but that didn't work correctly. So instead, it kind of bounced after it touched the surface and then bounced a couple of times and eventually came to rest under a cliff. Because remember, this is not like a spherical comet, but it's kind of bent L-shaped with these round edges. It came to rest under some kind of cliff or overhang, the shadow of which mostly blocked the solar panels that were supposed to power the lander. So then that led to it not having enough power to do all the things it wanted to do. But despite that, there was still a huge amount of really great science that came out of the Rosetta mission and these wonderful photographs. And one of the interesting findings about this comet, 67P, that I wanted to mention, this was from a NASA press release from September of 2020 called "Comet Discovered to Have Its Own Northern Lights." This was actually revealed with the help of NASA instruments that were part of the ESA Rosetta mission. What they found was that the comet has this invisible glow. It has an aurora of far ultraviolet radiation. These findings were published in Nature Astronomy of last year. And this electromagnetic glow was an aurora much like we see in the polar regions of Earth. So on Earth, the northern and southern lights are created when charged particles from the sun collide with gas particles in our upper atmosphere, and this results in reactions that create patterns of green, red, and white across the sky. Other planets in the solar system also have auroral phenomena. Jupiter does, I think even Mars does, many planets. But this is the first time we've ever observed it surrounding a comet. And a quote from the press release here, quote, "Electrons streaming out in the solar wind, the stream of charged particles flowing out from the sun, interact with the gas in the comet's coma, breaking apart water and other molecules. The resulting atoms give off a distinctive far ultraviolet light. Invisible to the naked eye, far ultraviolet light has the shortest wavelengths of radiation in the ultraviolet spectrum." Which makes me wonder if this comet could give you a sunburn. But anyway, I want to get around to the main study I wanted to talk about, tying into our overall theme today. So this is a study published in 2015 in Nature by Jean-Baptiste Vincent et al. Called "Large Heterogeneities in Comet 67P as Revealed by Active Pits from Sinkhole Collapse." So The authors here talk about how a lot of times when we get a look at the surface of a cometary nucleus, that's the hard icy core of the comet. Remember, a comet has, so it's got a hard core that's made of like ice and dust, the part you could walk on. And then it's surrounded often by a, you know, sort of cloud or tail. The coma is made of water vapor, dust, and gas. And when they get a look at this hard nucleus of a comet, we often observe pits. Now, there's one way that that might not be surprising, because if you think about other objects in the solar system, like the moon or asteroids, the dwarf planet like Ceres, they have a lot of pits also. And these are quite clearly impact craters. As these objects are bombarded by space junk over millions of years, these pits accumulate. And if the planets or moons don't have active geology like volcanoes and plate tectonics to repeatedly pave and smooth over the surface, the pits from ancient impacts just sit there, and they stay there, and we can see them easily. But there is a problem with explaining the pits on comets as impact craters. First of all, our best guess about how often comets encounter large impacts does not seem to correlate with the number of pits that we see. And then second, when we try to create physical models of what would happen when a comet suffered a high-speed impact, these models just don't create pits like the ones we actually observe. So what's making the pits? Some researchers have hypothesized that the pits are a result of internal explosions of some kind, but in the words of the authors, quote, the driving process remains unknown. So do we have any better guesses? Well, according to this study, yes, we do. So Rob, I want you to look at this next picture I've got for you here. This is a picture of Comet 67P shared by the ESA. And if you look at this comet from a close orbit under the right conditions, you can see what look kind of like shafts of light, almost like those Spielberg lights, you know, from Steven Spielberg movies. He loves these god lights, the shafts of light piercing through a dusty patch of air, or, you know, cutting through different obstacles in the foreground. You see these shafts of light blasting out of the surface of the comet. Like it makes me think of Indiana Jones saying, you know, lightning, fire, power of God, or something.
Yeah, it does bring to mind the fires of the Ark, or the lights of the UFOs, the various spaceships that are encountered in Spielberg films.
100%. So I was reading an article about this study by Phil Plait, the bad astronomer, at his blog on Sci-Fi, and he highlighted this image in particular, the one you're looking at now, Rob, in connection with the subject matter, this study. This photo is taken from a distance of about 177 kilometers, and the point of it is that what's being shown in these shafts of light in the image is not actually lightning or fire or power of God. They're not actually shafts of light. It is actually jets of water vapor that are gassing out from the surface of the comet and being illuminated by the sunlight. And I've got another photo for you to look at that's up close of these jets. It truly does look amazing.
Yeah, it creates this feeling that it is glowing or emitting energy, which in a sense it is emitting energy here. But yeah, it creates these are beautiful images. Like these would not look out of place, like framed on the wall of some sort of a trendy New York eatery or something.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, they have an almost artistic quality, but they're real photos. So scientists believe these jets are caused in the following way. A large part of the nucleus of a comet is made of water ice. As a comet with an irregular orbit gets to that part of its orbit closest to the sun, of course, the ice in its crust heats up and it melts or it sublimates. It vaporizes, turns into a gas. And these jets we see in the photos, this is the water vapor that is being exhaled into space by the crusty lobes. But here's where all of the different subjects we've been talking about come together. What we have recently observed in these images is that many of these jets seem to be shooting directly from the mysterious pits in the surface of the comet. Now, what does that mean? Well, the authors of this study in Nature conclude that the pits are probably sinkholes in space.
Well, that makes sense given what we've just discussed about the water vapor jetting out of them, right? It is leaving a hollow, and that's the very kind of situation that on Earth can lead to a sinkhole.
Exactly right. Now, these wouldn't be caused by the exact same process as natural sinkholes on Earth, just because it wouldn't involve things like rain drainage and such, but it's pretty close.
Right.
It's almost exactly the same thing. And what you're saying, Rob, is exactly correct. So the hypothesized mechanism works like this. The comet travels into the inner parts of its orbit, so it gets close to the sun. Heat from the sun warms the comet, turning the ice into water vapor. And apparently sometimes this heat penetrates the surface, sublimating large pockets of ice underneath the top layer of the comet. And then the water vapor gets blasted off into space, leaving these voids or caves underneath the surface where the ice used to be. Eventually, the overburden lying above these evaporated comet caves can't support itself, and it collapses, leaving a pit. And this can create an interesting feedback cycle, because now that there's a pit, radiation from the sun can penetrate deeper into the surface of the comet, warming even more ice below, which is why we see jets of water vapor shooting out of the pits themselves. These are sort of hot spots where the solar radiation can access pockets of ancient ice and heat them up very fast. The authors write, quote, "Here we report that pits on comet 67P Churyumov-Gerasimenko are active and probably created by a sinkhole process, possibly accompanied by outbursts. We argue that after formation, pits expand slowly in diameter, owing to sublimation-driven retreat of the walls. Therefore, pits characterize how eroded the surface is. A fresh cometary surface will have a ragged structure with many pits, while an evolved surface will look smoother. The size and spatial distribution of pits imply that large heterogeneities exist in the physical, structural, and compositional properties of the first few hundred meters below the current nucleus surface." So what they're saying there is that there's also probably a way to tell how old the pits are and how old the surface of the comet is by looking at these pits. Over time, the vaporization of ice erodes and smooths over the walls of the pit. So if you're looking at a comet, the older a comet sinkhole is, the smoother its walls and the shallower its pits become. And very new pits in less evolved comets are the ones with very steep, straight walls. It's kind of the exact opposite of how human faces age, right? So a very old piece of comet terrain that's been exposed to the sun many times, I guess, would probably have a smoother surface with shallower pits. And one where the pits are fresh, it's going to be craggier.
Yeah, it's interesting. But like you say, this is essentially a sinkhole in space, and not even in the most likely place you might think to find it, not on a planet, but on the surface of a comet.
Now, the one reason I said maybe actually it wouldn't be quite as bad to fall into a sinkhole in space, at least in this example, is that the gravity of the comet is so low that when you fell into the sinkhole, you wouldn't fall very fast, so you'd probably be fine when you hit the bottom.
Yeah. Or maybe you can catch an upward boost on one of those jets, right?
Right.
It sounds like a great place for an action scene to take place.
Ooh,
in space.
Yeah. Ice Pirates 2, Sinkhole City.
Sinkhole City sounds great. That sounds like exactly like the kind of place you'd want to wind up in a, like a space noir kind of a fiction. Yeah, Sinkhole City. I like it. Well, I feel like we've really expanded even more on the idea of the sinkhole, and hopefully worked a little more to rescue the sinkhole from the section at the bottom of blogs.
The chum box. That's not a word of my coinage. That's like a well-known term. I think it was a term innovated by somebody who wrote like a Gawker article or something about them a long time ago, about like how they're put together and what's in them. But that is not a term original to me, but I think it is a very good term. It's an apt description.
Yeah. I guess it's referring to the kind of like a slurry of meat that you throw out of a boat to attract sharks.
Yes, exactly. That is exactly what those boxes are. They're just like kind of throwing rotten garbage out there to see what comes up.
Yeah, and the sinkhole deserves better. The sinkhole is far more interesting. Certainly they do have this visceral impact on us. Just this, again, this idea of the Earth opening up and swallowing us whole, or exposing dark realms beneath the Earth. But there's much more beyond that, much more than just sheer terror or titillation. So hopefully we've urged everyone out there to to respect the sinkhole a little bit more. And obviously, yeah, we'd love to hear from anybody out there who, you know, if you've traveled to any of these sinkholes we've mentioned, if you've been to impressive sinkholes that we didn't get into in these episodes, or you just have general thoughts about them, we would love to hear from you. In the meantime, if you would like to listen to other episodes of Stuff to Blow Your Mind, you can find the Stuff to Blow Your Mind podcast feed wherever you get your podcasts. And wherever that happens to be, we just ask that you rate, review, and subscribe if the platform allows you to do so.
Huge thanks, as always, to our excellent audio producer, Seth Nicholas Johnson. If you would like to get in touch with us with feedback on this episode or any other, to suggest a topic for the future, or just to say hello, you can email us at contact@stufftoblowyourmind.com.
Stuff to Blow Your Mind is a production of iHeartRadio. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.
Picasso knows your vacation home is your best home. It's the place that brings family and friends together. It's where you're the best version of yourself. Picasso makes it easy to co-own a luxury vacation home in amazing locations. Listings start at $200,000 for 1/8 ownership. Picasso does all the work for you. Luxury furnishings, maintenance, billing, scheduling, and more. And you can resell on Picasso's marketplace anytime, historically for a 10% gain. Visit Picasso to see thousands of listings. That's PACASO.com.
Today's episode is brought to you by Visible. The future of wireless is here, and it's transparent. Switch to Visible, the wireless company that makes wireless visible. Get a one-line plan with unlimited 5G data powered by Verizon. Just $25 a month, every month, taxes and fees included. No hidden fees, no surprises, no, really.
What are you waiting for? Get with the times and switch to Visible at Visible.com. Monthly rate on the Visible plan. For data management practices and additional terms, visit Visible.com.
We are the voice of NASCAR.
The green flag is in the air, and we are underway. The Great American Race.
The Motor Racing Network. NASCAR Cup, Xfinity, and Craftsman Truck Series Racing. Live on your hometown radio station and MRN or NASCAR.com. Martinsville, Talladega, the Chicago Street Course. We have the side-by-side action and last lap passes for the win.
Photo finishes. Ryan Blaney will win.
The voice of NASCAR, the Motor Racing Network. Work.
This is Malcolm Gladwell from Revisionist History. eBay Motors is here for the ride. With some elbow grease, fresh installs, and a whole lot of love, you transformed 100,000 miles and a body full of rust into a drive that's all your own. Brake kits, LED headlights, whatever you need, eBay Motors has it. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time, or your money back. Plus, at these prices, you're burning rubber, not cash. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply.